Good afternoon, calling the State Affairs Committee to order at 3:09 p.m. Tuesday, May 2nd, 2017, in the Max Grunberg Room of the Alaska Capitol. Will the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Knopf?
Here.
Representative Wohl?
Here.
Representative Ledoux?
Here.
Representative Birch?
Here.
Representative Johnson? Representative Tuck? Chair Christ Tompkins?
Here. And with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 members present, we have a quorum to conduct business. And thank you, Heather and Cody, for helping us keep the committee running today. And also thanks to Calvin and Barrett, who've been tag-teaming with State Affairs in the absence of Stephanie, who has departed for previous engagements. And we have House Bill 200 on the agenda today. This is the first hearing, and the sponsor is a member of this committee, Representative Ledoux, as well as staff, Ms. Courtney Enright. And Representative Tuck has joined us at 3:10. Representative Ledoux, please present the bill.
Thank you very much. My name is Gabrielle Ledoux. I represent House District 15, which is East Anchorage, Muldoon, and the Elmendorf portion of J-Bear. And I am pleased to bring before this committee today House Bill 200, the top two nonpartisan primary. And before I forget, with me to answer any questions that I can't answer is my staff, Courtney Enright. The top two nonpartisan primary idea takes the state of Alaska out of the business of running primaries for private parties. Basically, it eliminates the concept of primaries serving to nominate candidates for parties. And instead, this primary serves not as something to nominate candidates from the parties, but it serves as a narrowing process where the candidates in the primary get narrowed down to the top two vote receivers. And the genesis of this bill is, as I spent time talking with my constituents, they consistently complained about the semi-closed primary system in place in Alaska. And Alaska benefited from an open primary system from 1946 to the year 2000. And then in 2000, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in California Democratic Party versus Jones that private parties could not be forced to open up their primaries to members of other parties. But the top two primary, that meets constitutional muster according to the U.S. to a U.S. Supreme Court ruling in Washington State Grange versus the Washington Republican Party, because it's not a primary that serves to nominate candidates from either party, but it simply serves as a winnowing process. And this bill brings the will of the people back to a more open primary system.
Thank you, Representative Ledoux. And I should note there is invited testimony lined up, including, I believe, two people on Eastern Daylight Time. So we'll try to go to them rapidly out of respect of their schedules. And perhaps if it suits the sponsor, maybe at this time we can go to invited testimony and then circle back to committee questions for either invited testimony or for the sponsor.
That would be great. I'd appreciate that.
Okay, so we have Andrew Sinclair with New York University, as well as Jason Olson with Open Primaries, the Director of National Outreach. We'll start with Mr. Olson. Mr. Olson, if you can hear us, can you put yourself on the record and present your invited testimony?
Yeah, thank you very much for the introduction. My name is Jason Olson, Director of National Organizing for Open Primaries. I'm testifying in favor of HB 200 and the efforts to bring back an open primary to Alaska. First, I'd like to thank the committee as well as Representative Ledoux for the invitation to testify. And, I appreciate your time and attention to this matter. Open Primaries, very briefly, is a nonprofit, nonpartisan national organization with a singular mission to ensure that no American citizen be required to join a political party in order to vote in a primary. Open Primaries is working in red states, blue states, purple states, and we work with Republicans, Democrats, and independents on this issue. My background is that I founded a group of independent voters in California that partnered with the coalition led by Republican former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger to bring a top two open primary to California, as well as reform the redistricting process. And since then, I've worked on the issue of open primaries in states all around the country. So why is restoring Alaska's open primary worth the support of the Alaska State Legislature? Well, in short, the voters of Alaska, along with those in California and Washington State, had their open primary stolen by a really terrible court decision in the year 2000. In that case, the California Democratic Party sued the state of California, which at that time had copied Alaska's open primary, in order to close the primary elections. And in short, in one of the worst Supreme Court decisions in a generation, the court sided with the political establishment of both parties against our citizens' basic freedom to vote for their elected representatives of the choice. This despite the fact that that primary elections are in fact taxpayer-funded, run by government employees, and conducted on public-owned voting machines. So Alaska, California, and Washington State, all which had the same open primary system in 2000, were forced to return to a semi-closed primary that voters in each state had previously rejected. This put all these states in a very difficult position. Now, voters in California and Washington State were able to fight back and, at the ballot, pass new open primaries through a ballot initiative. For this, they looked to Nebraska, which has used the top two open primaries since 1934, and the bill that Representative Ledoux has put forward is a model of that. So under the top two open primary, voters are free to vote for who they want. Legislators are free to do what they think is right for their constituents, rather than having to toe the party line. And most of these legislators, absolutely love it. The impact in California, for instance, has been tremendous. The legislature's approval rating is up from a low of 14% before the change to about 45% today. Budgets are passed on time. Voter participation and registration has begun to rebound, with a 48% voter turnout in California's June 2016 primary, which, I should note, took place after the presidential primaries were effectively over. In short, HB 200 is Alaska's chance to finally win back its open primary. So we urge you to support it, and we're happy to advise and assist in its passage in any way possible. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. And what I think we'll do is go next to Mr. Sinclair, and then at that point open it up for questions for all committee members. And Mr. Sinclair and Mr. Olson, if you have to drop off, please do, and we'll benefit from your ability to answer questions as long as you're able. But Mr. Sinclair, can you please put yourself on the record, state your affiliation, and present your invited testimony?
Sure. My name is Andrew Sinclair. I'm a professor at NYU's Wagner School of Public Service, and I'm not testifying for or against. I'm just here to provide what I know about nonpartisan primaries, which has been a major area of research for me, particularly focused on California's experience with the top two primary, which is used since 2012. And I'm the author of a Cambridge University Press book with my co-author Mike Alvarez, called Nonpartisan Primary Election Reform, Mitigating Mischief, which is a Federalist Papers reference. So California used the nonpartisan primary election rule for the last three cycles. That's enough to say something, but there's still a pretty considerable disagreement among political scientists about what to look at and what to make of the new rules. But we're sort of working on an active research agenda to be able to assess how this works. California's version of the top two is pretty simple.
Yeah. Mr. Sinclair, if you wouldn't mind, maybe change the distance you're talking into the microphone and or slow down as a few words are sort of dropping in terms of their clarity as we hear them.
Better?
I think so. Please continue, and we'll interject if the sound quality is too low.
Thank you. So California's version of the top two is pretty simple. It's the two candidates with the most votes advance to the general election.
And Mr. Sinclair, maybe what would help is if you can also just slow down, even if it seems sort of an excessive amount, just to make sure that we can hear as many words as possible.
Got it. Thank you. So in the primary stage in California, voters can choose any candidate. All the candidates compete against each other in a common pool, and then the two candidates that get the most votes compete against each other in the general election. Only about 15% of the time does this result in a general election between two candidates of the same party, so a Democrat against a Democrat or a Republican against a Republican. Most of the time, the general election looks like what you would see under the old system, but it does appear that the general elections between two candidates of the same party are more competitive, in some cases quite dramatically, than an election between cross parties. And they happen in places where we typically see very uncompetitive elections. So California, like many states, has some very lopsided electoral districts that are highly Republican or highly Democratic. And in those states, those districts do get more competitive elections sometimes through the system. For some of the things that other people think about, participation and moderation, for example, it's a little bit less clear how the top two works or how it might translate to the Alaska experience. I haven't seen compelling evidence that the top two disadvantages minorities, which is something that we looked at in our book, or other underrepresented groups causing voting rights concerns. We looked for this, but we really didn't find much. And most of what the top two seems to do is it happens through the way that candidates are paired, rather than massive changes in the way that voters behave. So it doesn't seem to be that, that voters are engaging in a great deal of strategic behavior. Most of the time, they sincerely vote for the candidate that they like the most. And then it just so happens that when you get to the next round, if you have two Democrats on the ballot in a very competitive district, then they have to compete over quality of representation or some other aspect like that. In general, some voters, as you would expect, like the rules, and others don't. There's still a lot of uncertainty on the part of voters, mirroring uncertainty on the part of political scientists about how these rules work and what to expect from the top two. And as they get more experience with it, we'll see changes in that, I'm sure. Basically, the punchline is that any reform effort or change to the rules, it comes with some advantages and some disadvantages. Generally, the way that I see the top two is that the advantages of increased competition seem to outweigh some of the disadvantages, but of course that involves a great deal of individual judgment. So my job is really just to assess how it works, not to make any specific recommendations on what you should do. And I'm happy to answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sinclair, and thank you, Mr. Olson. At this time, questions from the committee for the sponsor or either of the invited testifiers. Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to admit I picked up maybe 30% of the testimony from the last speaker, Mr. Sinclair, and I would ask that if he can provide his testimony in written form, if he could forward that to the chairman, that might be a little more legible. I met with the sponsor yesterday, and I have to say this: it strikes me as a solution in search of a problem. Maybe if we could have more more explanation as to the motivation behind this through the chair.
Well, as I was going door to door, I spoke to any number of people that said, you know, it really tees me off that when we go to the polls, we don't have our choice like we used to have. Maybe we want to vote for a Democrat for U.S. Senator and a Republican for governor in the primary, and we can't do that anymore. And they haven't been able to do that since, I think, the year 2000. And what really gets to people is, so we're actually paying, the state is, over $1 million to run these primaries, which are being run for private entities. I mean, the whole reason why either the Republicans or the Democrats are allowed to close their primaries is because the court ruled that they're more like private clubs that don't have to accept the votes of people who don't belong to that club or belong to another club. So if you take that for face value, then why is the state paying for these primaries? I mean, and that was the problem that many of my constituents had.
A follow-up question, Representative Birch?
Aside from the obvious, you know, rather self-serving nature of this legislation, and I would note that the Republican-Democrat thing was solved in Shungnak by just giving everybody one of each ballot, but I'm not sure that that passed muster exactly.
And by self-serving, you mean, Representative
well,
Birch?
Well,
and I just note, if comments could be made through the chair, that would be appreciated, but absolutely. Representative
well,
Birch, a question.
I guess the... Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the issue of party, and you know, it is an open primary. For instance, as you know, the Republican, I'm a Republican, on the Republican ballot, when you come up to the primary, some parties are free, as I understand it, to, you know, hold a convention or a, you know, whatever sort of purpose or structure that they choose to have a primary process for advancing a candidate. In the current process with respect to the primary, at least as far as the Republican Party is concerned, is all parties or all individuals who are not affiliated with another party are free to vote the Republican ballot. And I guess I think that's a system of advancing competent and capable people for each party, and it's one that I'm personally comfortable with and used to, and I have heard a lot of horror stories about where you do run into a problem when you start, you know, you have a party with a certain philosophy, and it strikes me that the public is best served by having that candidate advanced in a primary process. You do have the state does pay for it. You know, that's and maybe you can argue whether or not there should even be a primary. But in my view, this is not a good solution. Thank you, sir.
So through the chair, but you made a comment, the self-serving nature, and I was just trying to clarify that this bill would go into effect in the 2020 election, so that it has nothing whatsoever to do with the 2018 election and me. So if that was what you meant by the self-serving nature, then you're incorrect.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for the clarification, Representative Ledoux. Representative Knott, a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So Representative Ledoux, I'm trying to understand how it would work. Really, is it just as simple as going back to an open primary? So I'll ramble on here a little bit, and I'm sure we'll find a question in there ultimately. But so as I see it working, is you would have one ballot, not two, and all names would be on that ballot, and the top two vote-getters would end up in the general. So I guess a couple concerns, questions I would have is, I don't see the state removing itself. It's still a primary election. I don't see the state removing itself from that process, number one. Number two, would the candidates still put their party affiliation on the ballot with them? Because a lot of voters, as you know, are still party-oriented, and they want to vote for the party, not the candidate. So I'm curious about that. And then third and last, you have the potential for, I'll say, Republican governor and a Democratic lieutenant governor under that scenario. Is that accurate, fair to say? Is that possible? And is that good for the system, I guess, is what I'm asking.
All right, let's take, through the chair, let's take the first question at the time. And I'm trying to, there were several questions there, so I'm trying to remember what the first question was.
The state's role in primaries.
Okay, it would be just one ballot, and everybody would be on that one ballot. And the difference between the way this would be done now versus the way it was done prior to 2000. Prior to 2000, everybody was on one ballot, but they took the top Republican and the top Democrat and the top Libertarian, and everybody just advanced on to the general ballot if they were the top in their category. Under this scenario, it would simply be the top two which would advance on to the general ballot. And so it could be two Democrats, it could be two Republicans, it could be a Republican and a nonpartisan. It's whoever turns out to be the top two. And then your question... Yes, party through the chair. Party affiliation would be on the ballot. Everybody who wants to put their party affiliation on the ballot would have the option of putting their party affiliation on the ballot. If they decided, however, not to run with party affiliation next to their name, they could choose to do that. And then finally, you asked the question about could you ever end up with a situation in which you had a Republican governor and a Democrat lieutenant governor? Yes, you could under this system, but you can now, too.
Follow-up, Representative Knopf.
So the question about the state still operating it as a primary, though, so... It would still be the primary, it would still be managed by the state and the cost would still be there. So we're not really looking at saving dollars.
That, through the chair, that is correct, Representative Knopf. You wouldn't be saving dollars. I think there is a zero fiscal note on this. But at the same time, the state wouldn't be paying money to finance a private entity's nomination process.
One more.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if I recall, I think when the court decision was rendered and part of the arguments of that when the Republicans were advocating for the closed primary was the fact that they, I think, and don't get me wrong, I'm thinking on this, but it seemed like the conversation went something about, well, we think we have a weak candidate, so all the Democrats will come out in the primary, support the weak Republican, knowing he can be defeated in the general. I remember conversations like that back in them days. So is that not a concern any longer, or was it ever a concern? Or?
Frankly, I've been involved with both political parties in this state, and I never considered either of them organized enough that they'd be able to pull that off.
Thank you.
And I have Representative Tuck in the queue, but in light of the time, I want to interject a question to Mr. Olson in New York. And Mr. Olson, I noted in your testimony, you mentioned that the lawsuit in the early 2000s in California, the California Democratic Party sued, I forget who the defendant was, but it was
Jones,
whoever Jones is. It was a terrible decision, and I wanted to ask, what was the California Democratic Party's motivation for suing to prevent or to try to keep its closed primary? What were the arguments they presented, or maybe not their legal arguments, but why were they so motivated to try to hold on to their closed primary?
Well, and first of all, I did want to just throw in a plug for Professor Sinclair. I think earlier in his testimony, he answered the previous question, which is, do you ever see crossover voting? Do people vote strategically? And he said he's kind of studied this in great detail. He obviously speaks for himself. And in fact, that hasn't been the case. But to your question, which is a very good one, why did the California Democratic Party sue? They sued because they thought it was politically advantageous to the establishment of the party to rein in control of who could participate in the primary process. So in 1996, voters passed a proposition, I'm going to get the number wrong, I believe it was 198 in California, which copied Alaska's blanket open primary system at the time. And we were only into the second cycle of that. So it was still relatively new in California having an open primary system. Under the Alaska blanket primary system. So there was a lot of folks in both political parties. By the way, it was not, the case name is California Democratic Party versus Jones. Jones was the Secretary of State at the time. But that suit was joined by the Republican Party, the Libertarian Party, members of various political parties, and their motivations were very similar in that they just they didn't want anybody except their members, quote unquote, controlling who made the general election. So ultimately, they argued successfully that because they're private entities, the state could not regulate their primary process. And I believe it was a 7-2 decision on behalf of the Supreme Court, though there was a very strong dissent, they were basically casting doubt on the open primary systems, not just in California, Washington State, and Alaska, but also casting kind of a shadow over every open primary, partisan open primary system in the country. And ultimately, they prevailed on those arguments. I think that had that case been argued today with some more thinking in terms of, hey, what about the fact that the state funds these elections? Those arguments were not brought up at the time. It just wasn't part of the defense for the Secretary of State for California. Maybe they would look at that decision differently, but that they effectively ruled the parties are private entities, private associations, and the state cannot regulate their primary system. That's why ultimately when folks decided to look around for a new system, they went to a public system, which is the copy of the Nebraska top two system.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Representative Tuck, question?
No, thank you, Ms. Chair. Actually, that last speaker answered a lot of questions I had because it doesn't make any sense to me either why the state funds private, self-interested primaries and it with the exclusion of the general public. And I know that a Republican can grab a Republican ballot, and they can also grab a Democrat ballot because there's no limitation on them taking an open ballot for everybody else. I think one of the reasons why we used to have the open primary was to allow party establishment and smaller parties to allow themselves to gain traction. And so, the speaker just now just mentioned how we evolved into allowing these private primaries to happen. I've always said that, hey, you know, if the state of Alaska wants to allow that, then the party who wants to have a closed primary should reimburse the state of Alaska for the cost of doing that for them. Otherwise, do it the same way that we do presidential elections. You know, we do not do primaries for presidential elections. We have party organizations run their own primary processes, whether it's a caucus or a vote or however they determine that they're going to their own process for doing that, but they decide who their candidate is going forward at a local level all the way up to a national level. But I'm starting to warm up to this idea just a little bit more because it gets us back to that open primary process where people have a choice rather than being limited on who they're selecting, because a lot of times people aren't voting for the party. People are voting for the individual, and that individual opportunity is removed with the closed primary system that we have now. So the gentleman did answer a lot of the questions that I had.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do think I understand the system, the proposed and current, although it is a little complicated. My wife, I know, she's an independent, so she can go get a Republican ballot, but if she does that, then she can't vote for a particular person on the Democratic ballot if she wants to, so she's been a little frustrated with that.
The chair, yes, that's correct.
But this situation that's sort of come up in some of these letters, which is, let's say there's a predominantly a district that's say predominantly Republican, and on the primary, say four Republicans run for office, and two Democrats in this district, and when all the counting is done, just because there's so many Republicans, the Democrats end up winning the top two positions, and the people that live in that district, which is predominantly Republican, feel a little frustrated because they didn't get what they feel is their representation. Could that situation arise? And I guess you can't do a primary for the primary. So. Is that resolvable?
Theoretically, all sorts of things could arise, but I kind of looked at oh, let's say the 2014 election, the U.S. Senate election. So you have, this is predominantly a Republican state. So you had three people voting, running in the three major candidates running in the Republican primary. And then you had basically one person running as a Democrat. And the way it would have turned out in the ultimate analysis, it would have been under this system as opposed to the system which currently exists, it would have been Mark Begich versus Dan Sullivan. I mean, it's not always going to change things. And you can always come up with scenarios that there are, you know, a dozen Republicans running and they're all splitting the votes equally versus two Democrats who are also splitting the votes equally. But in reality, it's probably not going to work quite like that.
Thank you. And
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to also to respond to just what the experience has been in other states in that.
Yeah, and if that's you, Mr. Olson, please go ahead.
Yeah, and I'm sure Professor Sinclair may even jump in here too. But so the scenario that was outlined before, with, you know, essentially what happens when you've got a significantly Republican district and you end up with a whole bunch of Republicans running and maybe just two Democrats, what happens if you get the two Democrats going to the top two? Well, I just say from practical experience, and I'm talking about elections in Washington State and California, Nebraska, they've taken the labels off the ballot, so you can't really tell. But in California, Washington State, out of the more than, I want to say it's about 1,200 elections that have been conducted under this, probably more than that, actually. I think there's been about 3 to 5 instances of that happening. You know, when it has happened, again, so you're talking about a tiny fraction of all possible elections. And when it has happened, I think the benefit of that is that, in particular, this happened in California, in a Democratic heavily district, California being a heavily Democratic state. You had two Republicans end up in a runoff session. Those Republicans worked really hard to reach out to Democrats and independents because they wanted to hold on to that seat in the next election as well. And so this is my opinion, but I also think in the opinion of other folks in those districts, those Republicans end up working very, very hard for their constituents and kind of bent over backwards not to toe the party line, but to do what was in their best interest. But in terms of just sheer statistical, and again, perhaps Professor Sinclair has this off the top of his head, I'd say it's probably 3 to 5 elections out of 1,200 or so.
Yeah, this is Andy Sinclair from NYU. That's correct in my understanding. In California, I think it's 1 out of about 500 elections, something like that happened, and it was Congressional District 31 in 2012, and there was part of that was a redistricting story as well that sort of confused sort of who was going to be lining up to run where and ended up with a couple of Democrats all buying the same seat, and they didn't really successfully coordinate on which was going to be sort of the top one or two candidates for them. So they split the vote three ways, pretty close to 20% each, and two Republicans about 20% each, and the two Republicans just barely squeaked it out. And then the representative, which was I think Gary Miller, decided to retire after winning that seat, so retired before the 2014 election.
Thank you, Mr. Olson, Mr. Sinclair. Any follow-up, Representative Ball? I guess I have, actually, Representative Tuck, go ahead.
Okay. And thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems like to me, I don't see my fiscal note, I didn't bring it with me apparently, but it seems like to me that this would have a negative fiscal note, save the state money, because I can't imagine the effort that it would take to printing two separate ballots and then trying to predict how many of this you need to print versus how many of this you need to print with trying to figure out what the trends that people may end up doing and then and then having those delivered to each district based on individual predictions and individual makeups of those districts. So I'm really surprised that I would think this is a cost savings bill to the state of Alaska.
At least paper stock savings, if nothing else, it would seem. Ms. Enright.
Courtney Enright, staff to Representative Ledoux. I can speak a little bit to some of the details of that. So, yes, the simple answer is that there is a cost savings related to the number of ballots printed. However, you know, whenever you switch systems, there is some implementation costs expected. And the other caveat is in this system, if you have a special primary, there is, if you have a special election, you'd have to have a primary and then a runoff. And so, while there is an expected savings, I believe it's close to $100,000 per election under this system, they negated it because there's a couple other factors and potential.
I was going to have a follow-up question for Mr. Olson or Mr. Sinclair. I mean, in terms of these sort of, I guess, 1 in 500 events, it almost sounds like a flood or something. It's a 100-year flood or a 1 in 500 election. I mean, it would seem like beyond California, there's also data you can look at from Louisiana, and that they've had a jungle primary forever. But I'm seeing Representative Ledoux. Could you speak to that? Is Louisiana analogous to this?
Louisiana's jungle primary is slightly different. In Louisiana, if one candidate gets in the primary 50% plus one, then that person has won the election, and then there is no general election after that. So it is slightly different. It doesn't go into a top two runoff system.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, actually, this is Jason Olson. I would just say about the Louisiana system, I mean, it's called a jungle primary for a reason. It's different than a top two system in that there technically is no primary in Louisiana. Everybody runs in the general election, and then it's kind of like for municipal elections. If nobody gets 50%, then they go ahead and they move to a runoff election. The challenge with the Louisiana system is that those runoff elections, just like a lot of municipalities in the United States where they've got a ranked choice voting or whatnot, is that those runoff elections tend to be very low turnout events because they're in, you know, they're in late November. Some even hold them in early December. So it is different than top two. The top two is it's a public primary system, and while there are some similarities, there are some pretty marked differences as well.
This is Andy Sinclair from NYU, and I just wanted to say I agree with that entirely.
Thank you. Yeah, that makes sense, and I guess it's really like a second general election. Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This has probably come up already, but the situation that Representative Birch mentioned in, I can't remember the name of the District 40 race last year, where there was multiple ballots and people wanted to vote for this person on this party, but this person on the other party, and it was obviously a problem, whereas this single ballot would eliminate that situation.
Through the chair, it would certainly make it much more efficient in that way.
Thank you.
This is Andy Sinclair from NYU again. Can I add something else?
Please go ahead, Mr. Sinclair.
Thank you. Yeah, so one thing that's also different relative to Alaska's previous experience about having a single ballot with a nonpartisan top two system is that in the old blanket primary system, if your political party had only one candidate, that candidate was guaranteed to advance, and so there was nothing to even pay a cost for sort of voting for the weakest candidate in the other party's primary, which you could do. And that system has been declared unconstitutional now. But in the nonpartisan top two, if I want to vote for a weak candidate of a different party, I put at risk my preferred candidate. So you don't seem to see maybe even as much strategic voting behavior as you might have under the old system in Alaska.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a question, I guess, for the people calling in. Is this system we're looking at right now, the jungle primary, is that ever used in conjunction with the ranked...
ranked choice?
Ranked choice, yeah. So that way, if you did want to vote for a sort of more obscure candidate, you could put your second choice as a more mainstream candidate so as not to throw your vote away.
So this is Jason Olson from Open Primaries. It's not currently. It's not to say that it couldn't be. For instance, in the first round, that's been proposed in other areas. And I would just point out again, just for clarity, that the jungle primary refers to Louisiana's system, and the top two primaries, the Nebraska-style, the system that California and Washington State adopted after, like Alaska, they lost the blanket open primary.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, any closing comment, Representative Ledoux?
I think it's a good bill.
Noted. Thank you. Well, with that, at 3:50, we'll hold this bill for a further hearing. And we have a meeting, per usual, on Thursday. And thank you, Heather, Cody, Calvin, and Barrett. And we are adjourned at 3:50 p.m.